Hey everyone, happy Thursday. I am Janet B from New Jersey. I've recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia. And just to give you a quick history before I want to talk a little in depth about the real cause of my binging, but more important, how God launched his search and rescue program for me. So I call this talk Building a Bridge to God because, you'll hear why. So I first came into OA when I was in high school, and I was already a full-blown compulsive eater. I stole food, I stole money for food, and at my worst, I was binging and throwing up to six times a day. I had to actually have my esophagus surgically retightened because of the abuse that I had heaped on it. And I know sometimes people show their before and after pictures. My before picture would be a zombie, because even though I looked normal, I was a walking dead person. I could be in a room with all of you and feel like I was the only person on the planet. In addition to this, I was a compulsive liar. I made up crazy stories, including cutting myself with a razor, pretending I was mugged or raped, going to a hospital for a fake rape exam, taking the penicillin that the very nice nurse gave me so I wouldn't get syphilis from my fake rapist. And I continued acting this way, and I continued binging and purging for my first 7 years in OA. 7 years in OA, and I just kept getting worse, until I was introduced to the 12 steps and the God who I believe launches search and rescue programs for all addicts. And once I surrendered my life to God and committed to work this 12-step program, it was like a hand reached into my soul and yanked out the obsession. And by the grace of God, September 30th will be 38 years. And I am excited to talk about this God who is still alive and well and did not create the world in 6 days and sit back, take a day off and watch Netflix for the rest of eternity, but is still involved in our lives. The first thing I want to talk about is what I tried, why I thought I binged, and why I was wrong. I went to OA and I was really glad to know I wasn't the only one who ate that way. And I thought by going to meetings, I would get better, but that makes no sense. It would be like realizing I'm a diabetic, going to Diabetics Anonymous and thinking that just by sitting there, I'd get better. But the problem was, it was like going to Diabetics Anonymous and no one talked about insulin. There were big books there, but no one talked about it. No one used them. So I tried to figure out why, in spite of going to meetings and having sponsors and doing assignments, I didn't get better. I thought it was circumstances. I blamed it on my lousy upbringing, which in hindsight wasn't as lousy. My parents were nowhere as lousy at being parents as I was at being a daughter. I thought I binged because I was miserable. But when I was about 16 years old, this college boy invited me to a Beach Boys concert and I was in heaven. Those of you who are my age know what I'm talking about. I thought I was just, life was great. And I went out and binged. And so I said, I must be binging to sabotage my happiness. But I was wrong. Circumstances are never the cause of relapse. And I think a lot of us have been to meetings where people have said, or I know I had said, I binged because, and there's always a reason we give, right? Our lousy bosses, our lousy husbands, our rotten, annoying kids, always a reason. But I've since learned that if we're eating compulsively, it's always 100% of the time because there's something wrong with our spiritual condition. Never depends on circumstance. Remember Jim in chapter 3, he had his family, he had a job, and all was going well. But because he failed to enlarge his spiritual life, he got drunk. And we can contrast this with Bill Wilson in the chapter A Vision for You. On page 154, the text says he was bitterly discouraged, in a strange place, discredited, almost broke. That sounds pretty bad. But instead of getting drunk, he started Alcoholics Anonymous because, and I think this is important, because he had surrendered his life to God and therefore he was protected. See, we don't not binge because we're good or because we work hard. the only way we're able to not binge is because we're protected by God. Doesn't have to do with circumstances. Okay, so if it wasn't circumstances, was it lack of knowledge? Did I need to know better what foods were triggering me? And I see this sometimes. People say, I have to tighten up my food plan, tighten up my food plan, tighten up my food plan. I had food plan after food plan that eliminated my binge foods. And I must have done the assignment to write a history of my compulsive eating 20 times. And guess what? I still couldn't stop. Because my problem wasn't lack of knowledge. Like, imagine someone going to the oncologist, being shown an x-ray or a CAT scan or whatever they use, and being told, see that spot there? That proves you have cancer. Now that you have knowledge that you're a real cancer patient, now go make your cancer cells stop multiplying. Well, of course, a doctor would never say that. And yet, how many times was I told that if I really knew that I was a compulsive eater, I could stop? Okay, so it wasn't circumstances. It wasn't lack of knowledge. Maybe I didn't want it badly enough. During those first 7 years in OA, I had, I kid you not, about 50 different sponsors. And I kept getting dropped with people thinking and sometimes saying, oh, she just doesn't want it badly enough. I think that sometimes people assume that if someone can't stop binging, it's because that person doesn't really want to stop. We confuse desire with power. We think that lack of desire is the problem. I had the desire to stop, I just didn't have the power. And that's actually what our book tells us. On page 24, it says that at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, or for us, the binging of every compulsive eater, passes the most powerful desire to stop drinking or overeating is of absolutely no avail. So there I was, 7 years in, still binging, with my binges growing more and more frequent, more and more severe. I had knowledge, I had desire, but I didn't have power. But what does this mean to have no power? Obviously, there wasn't a furry little creature that kept shoving my hand into a bag of this or a carton of that. It was me who did it. So what does it mean to have no power? And this is so, so important to understand that the writers of the Big Book put the paragraph that explains it in italics. On page 24, it says, we are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. So let's break that down. Normally, my defense against doing something dangerous is my memory. Let's say I'm about to touch a hot stove. Well, in my memory are stored all these data points telling me that hot stoves are dangerous. So if I'm about to touch a hot stove, my memory will send a little thought running across the bridge that connects my memory to my conscious mind and says, stop, danger, hot stoves will burn you. And then I don't touch the stove. Or another example, I have terrible cat allergies. Stored in my memory right here are a bunch of data points of cat-induced asthma attacks. So if I'm tempted to go to a pet store, visit a friend who has a cat, my memory will generate a thought and send that little cross to run across the bridge that connects to my conscious mind and says, stop, danger, cats will give you asthma attacks. So again, my memory keeps me away from danger. Now let's talk about food. In college, I used to binge on these certain kind of cookies. They'd come in a box of 20. I'd buy a box and I'd always say, I'm going to have just one or two. But we know the end of that story. I'd end up eating the whole box of 20 and sometimes more. So stored in my memory were all these data points of Janet promising herself she's going to eat just one, but end up eating the whole box. So I'm about to go to the store to buy a box of cookies, telling myself I'll just have one. And my memory does its job. It generates a little thought and then goes to run across the bridge to my conscious mind to say, stop, danger. You won't be able to stop at one. You'll eat the whole box. Then you'll hate yourself. You'll get fatter. You'll make yourself throw up. Don't do it. except when it came to food, the bridge was broken. The bridge between my memory and my conscious mind was broken. So that thought couldn't get across. My memory failed to hold me in check. I had no defense against the first compulsive bite. I couldn't keep the memory green. I couldn't just tell myself to stay away from certain foods. When it came to food, the bridge between my memory and my conscious mind, my will, was broken. And once broken, it could never, ever be repaired. I was hopeless. Just like Bill Wilson, when he realized he was hopeless and said on page 8 of the book, "No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. For me, food was my master. I had a broken bridge." Okay, so our bridges are broken. No connection between our memory and our conscious mind when it comes to food. How did it get broken? There are a couple answers put forth by two different AA doctors. Dr. Bob says that selfishness played an important part in bringing on his alcoholism. Dr. Paul, who wrote the story, Acceptance Was the Answer, said in his book, There's More to Not Drinking Than Not Drinking. He said, God stamps every 10th baby an alcoholic. So basically what they're saying is, we don't know how we became alcoholics or compulsive eaters. Usually we want to figure it out so we can figure out who to blame. But our program tells us we can't do that. So all I know is I don't know quite how it got broken. I just know once it's broken, it can't be fixed. So how did I recover and how do we all recover? Because it's the same, right? If we all do the same work, we get the same results. What do we do when our bridges are broken? And the answer is we build another bridge, and that's a bridge to God. We build that bridge to God so that God can come over and protect us. How does it start? Well, it starts with willingness. Now, remember, willingness does not mean being willing to stick to a food plan, because I am powerless to do that. Willingness means willing to do the work that allows God to come in and remove the obsession. Herb Kay has said that willingness allows grace to enter. Isn't that pretty? Willingness allows grace to enter. And on page 58 of our book, it says that if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then, and I say then and only then, are you ready to work the steps? So in other words, if a person isn't willing to go to any lengths, they shouldn't work the steps. They shouldn't get a sponsor. They shouldn't work the steps because it won't work. And then what will happen is they'll make some false starts and they'll walk away saying, this program doesn't work. When the truth is, it doesn't work if we're not willing to go to any lengths. Now, if you're a smart aleck like I used to be, you might say, well, I'm not willing to rob a bank. Does that mean I can't recover? But of course, the willingness they're talking about has to be in line with recovery principles of this book. And robbing a bank would clearly violate, the principle of honesty, unselfishness, and probably about 20 more. So a good example of why willingness has to be the first layer in our bridge is found in the chapter of Vision for You, where we see how Bill Wilson told Dr. Bob all about the recovery program. And Dr. Bob was enthused about it. He said he would do anything except admit he was an alcoholic to his patients. And of course he got drunk again, because as long as we say we're willing to do anything except fill in the blank, we won't recover. But as we know, that story had a happy ending, because once Dr. Bob decided he would face his problem squarely so that God might give him mastery. So see, he knew God was the only answer. He went about and told everyone he knew who he was afraid to tell, hey guys, I'm an alcoholic. And he stopped drinking and AA was born. His willingness allowed God to do a great and mighty work through him. Okay, so we're willing. What's the second material needed to build our bridge? And I think it's faith. It's being willing to believe a power greater than us can restore us to sanity. I once looked in the book to see, where does recovery start? Where do we start getting power? It doesn't start with admitting we're powerless, or getting the right food plan, or making a certain number of phone calls or meetings. On page 46 of the big book, it tells us that as soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power. There it is, power and direction, provided. So it's a conditional promise. Power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. So starts at step two, and then we get more and more only if we keep working the steps. To me, that line is so exciting because remember, lack of power is my problem. So my solution has to be an infusion of power, like a pick line to my heart. And as soon as I admit the possibility of God, I get power. Well, that's all well and good if I have a working relationship with God. But if I had a working relationship with God, I probably wouldn't have been in the mess I was in the first place. So what do I do if I believe in God, but don't think he can or will help me with my binging? Or what if I don't believe in God at all? Well, on page 158, we see AA number 3 saying, and I'm paraphrasing, maybe God can help me, maybe. His faith started with a maybe. And I found that when we're starting out, if we're not sure God can help, or even if he's there, it's okay to start with a maybe prayer. The prayer may go something like this. God, I'm not sure you exist. And if you do exist, I don't know if you care about me. But if you are there and you do care, I need some help. And the worst that may happen is that there's no God and you end up just talking to air. But what if there really is a God? What if there is? And what if that prayer tells God, you know, allows God to then call up his band of angels with their mini hard hats and mini tool belts and say, okay, guys, it's time to go to work in Janet's soul. Sheep knocked, we're answering the door. But the big book also talks about things that can block our belief in God. There's different prejudices, and then there's like cataracts, spiritual cataracts. Bill talks about having scales of pride and prejudice that blinded him to the reality of God. Pride, thinking of myself too much and thinking too much of myself, right? Because if I think I'm wonderful, I won't know that I need God. And prejudice, thinking too little of others and thinking of others too little. These are the things that blind us to God. And in the chapter, we agnostics, we're told we have to look at our prejudices. So if we're having trouble, we start by looking at our prejudices. And there's at least half a dozen that can be teased out of that chapter. And the chapter also warns us of things that can obscure our view of God, spiritual cataracts, calamity, right? Bad things that have happened, pomp, worship of myself, and worship of other things, money, career, another person. So it's important, it's critical actually, that we find out what our own personal prejudices are and what are our spiritual cataracts so we can hurry on up and get into that love relationship with God. I did a podcast on We Agnostics. It's like two part and go really in depth on the different spiritual cataracts and prejudices. So if anyone wants more in depth, that's where they are. So, okay, so let's assume now we have faith. We're willing and we say, okay, I believe God can help me. The next layer of my bridge is surrender, because what good is it if I believe in God and God can help me, but I'm out robbing banks? Clearly, I can't expect to recover. So the next layer is surrender. We make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand him. What does that mean? Like, I just remember for years thinking, like, what does that mean to like turn it over? And it simply means I do what I think God wants me to and leave the results up to him. And I think this part is really important to understand. Generally, we have goals, and the goals are often good ones, like get my husband to stop smoking, raise respectful children. However, those are my goals. And it's radically different when my goal is simply this, a four-word life mission statement, to do God's will. To do God's will. So for instance, in this example, if my goal is to raise respectful children and I try my hardest and do the right thing most of the time, because obviously we'll never do the right thing all of the time. There are days when I don't do the right thing hardly any of the time. Let's say I raise my kids well, but they're not respectful. In a pre-third step model, where I have a goal of raising respectful kids, I'll get resentful and fearful, and I'll feel like a failure and get depressed and probably start doing lots of wrong things like screaming or manipulating my kids in order to reach my goal. However, if my goal is simply to do God's will, and I believe that God's will is for me to teach my children manners and things like that, I may do the exact same thing while raising my children, same exact things. But when my mission statement is simply to do God's will, I'm less apt to get angry, fearful, and frustrated because I'm not focused on the results, having respectful children. I'm only focused on my obedience to God. So in other words, the goal shifts from achieving something, even if that something is good, to simply doing the will of God. And that's all that surrender is. That's it. So now I've got a layer of willingness, a layer of faith, and a layer of surrender. So I've got a rickety bridge connecting me to God, but there's more work to do because I need a bridge sturdy enough to withstand the certain trials and low spots that page 15 promises me are ahead. So I need to clear up the obstacles on the bridge, those things that are blocking me from getting up close and personal with God. And those obstacles are my resentments, my fears, and the harms I've committed. You know, in our book, it says selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of the illness. But remember, if we're looking at a tree, we don't see the roots. We just see the fruit. Resentment, fear, and harms to others. So I inventory all of that, and I share them with an understanding person, generally our sponsors. And then there's the most beautiful promises. It says, we feel we are walking hand in hand with our Creator. We begin to experience the nearness of our Creator, hand in hand. And it says the feeling that the drink problem, or for us, the food problem, has disappeared will often come strongly. So by step five, we're not obsessing about food all that much anymore. Often, we're not obsessing. And then I take a good long look at my defects of character, the things that block me from God. And then something really cool happens. Even though I caused all these obstacles, these boulders that separate me from God, my self-pity, my harms to others. God doesn't make me lift them myself. He could have. He'd have every right to say, Janet, you made this mess. Now you clean it up. I'll be waiting for you, but you need to clean it up, girl. But he knows that I can't. So he picks up the boulders that are too heavy for me to lift, and he removes my character defects. In other words, it's not really I'm building a bridge to God. It's God's helping me build a bridge, or probably even better, God's building the bridge from me to himself, and I'm just pitching in a bit. And once my defects are removed, I can go out and make amends to the people I've harmed. And then I've got my bridge. I have a connection with God as long as I continue to do those three things. One, I have to clear away the wreckage of each day. That's our step 10. Two, our step 11, I have to communicate with God through prayer and meditation. I mean, what good is it to say, God, I'm going to do your will, but if I don't give him the time and space to let me know what his will is? At my job, I make sure to give my boss time and space to tell me what he wants done. How much more so do I need to do that for my real employer with a capital E? So prayer and meditation. And the third thing I need to do is practice these principles of honesty, self-sacrifice, and the like, and help other people build their bridges. And if I do that, I am promised immunity against compulsive eating. The first line of the chapter, Working with Others, tells us that nothing will ensure immunity as intensive work with other alcoholics or for us compulsive eaters. Immunity, as my friend Melissa says, is like when we get a vaccination for a disease, we have immunity against that disease. Or the way I like to think of it, I always think of Law and Order. When a diplomat from another country comes into New York and commits a crime, but the cops can't touch him because he has immunity. He's untouchable. So by building my bridge and helping others build theirs, I have immunity and the illness can't touch me. So at the beginning, when I started, I said that I believe God launches search and rescue missions for addicts. He certainly launched one for me, and he didn't just rescue me, and he didn't just restore me to sanity, but he gave me a life better than one I ever could have planned. I don't lie anymore, ever. Me, the one who like went to hospitals and could like went to a hospital and could like fake it with a nurse that I'd been raped and just lied about everything. I don't lie ever. I remember when my kids were teenagers, they'd say, Mom, did you look at my text? Because they knew if I did, I would confess. I had to, right? My son told his girlfriend once, this is when he was 18, my mom's a lot of things, but she's not a liar. I don't know if that's a compliment or not, but from an 18-year-old boy, I'll take what I can get. My marriage is good. My career is good. And even during this time of coronavirus, I do have a great sense of purpose. I have the best friends I could ever want. And I have a God who will never let go. And I want to close with a few words specifically for the compulsive eater listening today, who's feeling like I was for my first 7 years in OA. And I went to meetings and made phone calls.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you. There's a lot of noise coming. I don't know if you're hitting the microphone with paper, but every so often it gets kind of loud.
Okay.
Thank you. You know. Sorry.
So if there's someone who's feeling like I was during my first 6.5 years in OA, when I went to meetings, made phone calls, turned over my food, went through a revolving door of sponsors and still didn't get it. Those things I did weren't enough, because the only solution put forth for a real compulsive eater is a miracle. Remember when Bill was 12-stepped by Ebby, he said, here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. But the coolest thing is that our book gives us the recipe for a miracle. On page 57, when describing a hardcore alcoholic who was restored to sanity by God, the text says, "What is this but a miracle of healing? Yet its elements are simple." Okay, that's crazy. They're telling us it's simple to like replicate a miracle. But here's the elements. Here's the recipe. One, said circumstances made him willing to believe. There's his first step and his second step. Then he humbly offered himself to his maker. Then he knew. His third step. Then he knew. Admission of powerlessness, willingness, and surrender. And I believe every single one of us could have that miracle, because there really is a God who is alive and well and waiting to help us build our bridges to him.